Today you are seeing Sarah, a 21-year-old woman, for a routine physical. She is interested in contraception and has read up on how effective birth control pills are in preventing pregnancy. She asks you what makes them work so well, and would like to know what the pills will be doing to her body if she decided to use them. Hi and welcome to Audio Bricks. I'm Alex Dennis, and this is the brick on ovulation and the menstrual cycle. Let's jump right in! After completing this section, you'll be able to 1. Describe the phases of the ovulatory cycle and how ovulation occurs. 2. Describe the phases of the menstrual cycle and how the endometrium changes during the cycle. 3. Describe how gonadotropin-releasing hormone, follicle-stimulating hormone, luteinizing hormone, estrogen, and progesterone work in concert to control the menstrual and ovulatory cycles. And 4. Describe the timing of the various phases of the menstrual and ovulatory cycles, including the hormonal changes that occur during each phase. I've always thoroughly enjoyed the endocrine system because of the simplicity of the hormone axes. For the most part, its hypothalamic hormone goes down to the pituitary gland, another hormone comes off there, goes to the end organ, hormone comes out from there and exerts negative feedback onto the brain, and boom, voila. Copy-paste on any hormone axis. The menstrual cycle is a bit more complicated, which seems to throw the whole thing off. Let me assure you it's not that bad. And hopefully, by the end of this break, you'll appreciate how the same endocrine paradigm is at play in the menstrual cycle, with just a few twists added. Let's take a look at this physiologic process and, more importantly, how it regulates all aspects of the female reproductive system. Part 1. What are ovulation and the menstrual cycle? Every 28 days, most women of reproductive age release an egg, or ovum, from their ovaries for potential fertilization by a sperm and a resulting pregnancy. This is ovulation. The cycle of events that prepares the egg for this event is the ovulatory cycle. But the egg also needs a supportive place to land and grow after fertilization. This place is the endometrial lining of the uterus. The menstrual cycle prepares the uterus for implantation of the egg and aligns precisely with the ovulatory cycle, also starting anew every 28 days. How can all of this machinery line up? It happens because of exacting hormonal control by the brain, specifically the hypothalamus and pituitary glands. But before we get into a discussion on the key hormones governing the whole process, let's look at what happens in the ovary and uterus. We'll bring together the whole picture at the end. It's complex, but well worth the trouble to learn. Let's do a quick question before getting into the meat of it. What is the difference between the ovulatory cycle and the menstrual cycle? The ovulatory cycle refers to the cycle of events that prepares the ovum to be released from the ovaries. The menstrual cycle, on the other hand, is from the perspective of the uterus, so it's the cycle that prepares the uterus for implantation. Both cycles happen at the same time. Part 2. What is the ovulatory cycle? The ovulatory cycle involves preparation in the ovary to produce an ovum, or egg. The ovum eventually travels down to the uterine or fallopian tube, it gets fertilized there, and then implants in the uterus. Females are born with more than 1 million ova, but atresia, or steady degeneration, eventually cuts that number down to less than 1,000 at menopause. Unlike sperm in a man, no new oocytes are made during the life of a woman. Isn't that wild to think about? Every 28 days, usually a single oocyte is released from the follicle. This process of ovulation leads to a released ovum that is now ready to be fertilized. The ovaries are adjacent to the uterine tubes, and the egg moves into the tube, which carries it towards the uterus. If the egg is fertilized by a sperm in the uterine tube, it develops and implants in the uterus about a week after fertilization. Oocytes reside and develop in ovarian follicles, which are oval structures within each ovary. These follicles are the basic units of female reproductive biology. It's kind of funny to think that the ovary is just a bag filled with a bunch of mini bags, i.e. the follicles. And if you've been following our podcast series so far, that's very similar to what I said previously about the thyroid, right? A bag filled with a bunch of mini bags, which in that case were also the follicles. Anyways, I remember that each follicle contains a single precious oocyte, so it's important that it be well padded, pun intended. Imagine a few layered concentric circles. The innermost is the ovum. The ovum is immediately surrounded by a single layer of granulosa cells, which respond to follicle-stimulating hormone, FSH, produce sex hormones, and support the ovum. A layer of theca cells on the outside of the follicle forms supporting the connective tissue. Remember that theca cells actually surround the follicle and are not within it, because they develop from interfollicular stroma in response to hormones released by the follicle. Let's take a quick second for a review question. What is the phenomenon that accounts for the loss of the majority of the ova from birth to menopause? Though we do lose an ovum or so per month via ovulation, most of the ova are lost through a process called atresia, the degeneration of follicles which do not ovulate during the menstrual cycle. More on this later. Okay, so now let's dig deeper into the ovarian follicle. The development of the follicle with its oocyte is called folliculogenesis, or folliculization. Let's start with the basic events, and then we'll talk about how those are hormonally regulated. At birth, women only have primordial follicles in their ovaries. These are small, and in fact the smallest they'll ever be, inactive, and may lie dormant for years. Each primordial follicle is a primary oocyte surrounded by a flattened layer of granulosa cells. Their cell division, meiosis, is arrested in its first stage, meiosis 1. My trick for remembering this is that this is step 1, so it's stopped in the phase 1, i.e. prophase, of meiosis 1. 1-1-1. And if we want to zoom in on what this phase looks like, this is when all the genetic material is super condensed into 23 tetrads, a tetrad being made of paired paternal and maternal homologous chromosomes, each made of two chromatids. Moving on, these follicles then start to mature in the fetus in mid-gestation and gradually break down over the lifespan. That's why primordial follicles number approximately 1 to 2 million at birth, about 300,000 at puberty, and so on, decreasing with age. Now, what prompts a primordial follicle to move into the next stage and become a primary follicle is not understood. Probably magic, right? Well, estimates are that this process begins as many as 6 to 8 months prior to ovulation. Once a follicle leaves the initial pool, it either ovulates or becomes atretic and dies. There's no resting state once this recruitment has occurred. Alright, so we're at the primary follicle now. Not too much has happened, but there are subtle changes. The primary oocyte increases in size and is surrounded by a cuboidal layer of granulosa cells. Gap junctions between cells develop at this stage. Primordial and primary don't sound too different, so they don't look too different either. The next stage after primary follicle is, as you guessed it, the secondary follicle. Things are starting to get mildly exciting. These follicles now have several layers of granulosa cells, and a distinct outer layer of theca cells is apparent. They are now a staggering tenfold larger and acquire blood supply at this stage. Development up to the mid-secondary stage occurs independent of gonadotropin secretion. Sometime between the mid-secondary and tertiary stages, follicles become responsive to and dependent on circulating hormones, particularly FSH secreted by the anterior pituitary. More on this later. Before we complete our transition from secondary to tertiary follicle, what does a primordial follicle look like? A primordial follicle contains an oocyte surrounded by a flattened layer of granulosa cells. That's it. And in the primary follicle, that layer adopts a more cuboidal or perked up appearance. Moving on now. Secondary follicles stimulated by FSH develop into tertiary follicles. Quick pause here. What does FSH stand for? FSH stands for follicle stimulating hormone. And I'm asking this question just so you see how aptly named it is and never forget its main action. FSH comes in and what happens next? Just about what you'd expect at this point. Granulosa cell numbers increase. The rapid growth causes the appearance of the antrum, a space in the granulosa compartment. Early antral follicles, or follicles with an antrum, are those capable of becoming ovulatory follicles. Eventually, one of the tertiary follicles becomes dominant over the others, so it grows and ruptures. The ovum that was contained within the follicle, along with some of its surrounding granulosa cells, then leaves the ovary to migrate down the uterine tube. The other follicles, along with their oocytes, die off. Ruthless. This is ovulation. A quick question since we've now crossed the halfway point of the ovulation cycle. What cells of the follicle do not accompany the ovum on its way out of the ovary? The theca cells, which surround the follicular capsule, remain behind in the ovary after ovulation. And that's a great segue for what comes next. After the oocyte and its accompanying granulosa cells leave the follicle, the empty follicle is now called a corpus luteum, which actually means yellow body. The sac is lined by luteal cells, the descendants of the follicular theca, and some granulosa cells. These cells will be important sites of progesterone and estrogen synthesis if pregnancy proceeds. The name is fitting because once the egg has left the follicle, the luteal cells begin to hypertrophy and accumulate lipid, producing a yellow color. Quick stop here for a review question. How is the corpus luteum different from the follicle? The corpus luteum consists of the lining cells of the follicle after the ovum has been released. So basically, a transformed follicle minus the ovum. Part 3. What is the menstrual cycle? During the 28-day menstrual cycle, the uterine endometrial lining builds up to support a fertilized egg, then sloughs off if no implantation occurs. The idea is to provide a fresh environment every time there's a possibility for implantation. It's like if there's a possibility that your in-laws might be visiting for a few days. They might not, but you wash the bed sheets in advance, otherwise you won't have time to by the time they come. This is all well coordinated with the ovulatory cycle under similar hormonal control. The uterine endometrium, where the fertilized egg implants, is the inner functional epithelial cell layer of the uterus. Unlike most epithelia, it thickens, then sheds every 28 days. Again, to keep it fresh. This thickening is driven by the hormones estradiol and progesterone and is coordinated so that maximum thickness happens when a fertilized egg is ready to implant. If no egg implants, it sheds as the monthly period, or menstruation. If, on the other hand, a developing fertilized egg at this stage of blastocyst does implant, the blastocyst erodes through the thickened endometrium into the uterine subepithelial connective tissue. The placenta then forms from tissue from both the mother and the developing blastocyst and grows to support the fetus. Stimulated by estradiol, the endometrium thickens by proliferation of the innermost functional layer of columnar epithelial cells as well as by formation of tubular glands. Estrogen also induces progesterone receptors on the endometrial cells. In contrast, progesterone causes the glands to become torturous. Mitotic activity markedly decreases and glandular secretions increase. This secretory endometrium has a rich blood supply that supports proliferation as well as growth of the fetus. Quick pause here. Which layer of the endometrium did we say undergoes proliferation and shedding during the menstrual cycle? The functional layer of the endometrium undergoes proliferation under the influence of estrogen. Now, let's look at ovulation and endometrial function together. Keep in mind, yes, this will require some studying, but also if you can appreciate the logic behind how each stage of the menstrual and ovulatory cycles overlap, you'll be able to infer them at any time. Both the ovulatory and menstrual cycles last 28 days. Makes sense so far. The ovulatory cycle is divided into two phases, follicular and luteal, divided by ovulation, whereas the uterine cycle has three phases, menses, proliferation, and secretion. Imagine now a little follicle. Let's start from a primary follicle, growing into a tertiary, i.e. pre-ovulation follicle. As it's growing, it's releasing more and more estrogen. That estrogen travels a short distance to the endometrium and promotes its growth. Therefore, from day 4 to 14, we're in the proliferative phase of the endometrium. At ovulation on day 14, the follicle ruptures, with remaining theca and granulosa cells forming the corpus luteum that functions from days 15 to 22. If there's no fertilization, then the corpus luteum decreases in size from days 22 to 28 and eventually atrophies. Recall that if the ovum had instead been fertilized and then implanted, the corpus luteum would stay patent and large, producing hormones to support the pregnancy. After ovulation, the endometrium is still growing, because remember, there are 7 days from fertilization to implantation. But this time it's focusing on things like getting extra blood just to ensure that the implanted blastocyst can receive all the nutrients it needs. If there's no fertilization, the corpus luteum, which is what feeds the endometrium to grow, breaks down, and so does eventually the endometrium. So days 25 to 28 of the cycle, the endometrium stops growing and shrinks. The eventual sloughing off is the beginning of the menses and represents days 1 to 4 of the new cycle. Important! Beginning of menses defines day 1 of the cycle, regardless of how long the cycle lasts. Wow, we went over a lot of stuff. Are you still with me? Let's find out with a quick question. What causes the shrinking of the endometrium around day 25 when there is no fertilization and implantation? If there is no fertilization of the ovum, the corpus luteum, which feeds the endometrium via hormones, breaks down, causing the endometrium to also start breaking down. Part 4. How do hormones control ovulation and menstruation? The key hormones involved in the control of ovulation are the components of the hypothalamic-pituitary-gonadal axis. This consists of gonadotropin-releasing hormone, or GnRH, which stimulates the anterior pituitary release of luteinizing hormone, or LH, and FSH. Can we just appreciate how aptly named LH is as well? Luteinizing hormone luteinizes the follicular remnant post-ovulation to turn it into the corpus luteum. It's not often names are this insightful. Anyways, FSH and LH act on the ovarian follicles to produce estrogen and progesterone, which are both steroid hormones. These hormones are also produced in the adrenal gland, but in women, the synthesis in the ovarian follicles is most important until menopause, when all follicles are exhausted and hormonal secretion from the ovaries stop. So let's go over what estrogen and progesterone do exactly. Estrogen is important throughout the reproductive cycle. It increases vaginal lubrication, stimulates growth of the endometrium, and along with androgens, it increases sex drive. A rise in estrogen during the ovulatory cycle will stimulate the surge in LH that causes ovulation. More on that in a minute. On the other hand, progesterone is the main supporter of the growing endometrium and placenta during pregnancy, assisted by estrogen. It decreases uterine contractility, preventing premature labor. Because its major effects are observed during pregnancy, it is sometimes called the hormone of pregnancy. I realize this is a pretty gross simplification, but it's always been helpful for me to remember what stages these hormones are most important by grouping them alphabetically. Follicular phase is stage 1. Then comes FSH and estrogen, or FNE. And for luteal stage, I think LH and progesterone, LNP. Again, each of these hormones have actions and are present throughout the cycle, but this is a good rule of thumb. Let's pause for a quick question. Which hormone is most important in maintaining the uterus and placenta during pregnancy? Progesterone is most important in maintaining the uterus and placenta during pregnancy. Remember it as the hormone of pregnancy, progesterone pregnancy. Okay, let's continue. The regulation of estrogen and progesterone, and all of the steps of the ovulatory and menstrual cycles, begins at the hypothalamus. There, the pulsatile release of GnRH by the hypothalamus is the basis for all reproductive hormone changes. The pulsatile frequency changes in response to many factors, including environment, age, and time of the month. GnRH is released into the hypophyseal portal vasculature, then binds to its receptors on the anterior pituitary gland, causing this gland to release LH and FSH. Pretty traditional so far. Let's now look at the feedback that happens at the level of the pituitary. Like most hormones, LH and FSH undergo negative feedback. LH and FSH bind to their target organs in the ovary, and estradiol and progesterone are produced as a result. Estrogen and progesterone then induce feedback to reduce LH and FSH release. But an important note for you here is that estrogen and progesterone are not the only hormones to exhibit negative feedback. The ovary also produces inhibin, which inhibits the anterior pituitary's release of FSH. Don't let that distract you. It's a detail in the grand scheme of your conceptual understanding. The big twist in the menstrual cycle that I was mentioning at the beginning of the break is that, for whatever reason, there's a tipping point where estrogen concentration becomes so great right before ovulation that it becomes stimulating rather than inhibiting towards GnRH and LH release. that it becomes stimulating rather than inhibiting towards GnRH and LH release. And that is the only exception to the traditional endocrine axis layout in the menstrual cycle. We'll circle back to this, but it's such an important point to understand that I thought I'd let it sit with you for a bit. Now, back to LH and FSH. Let's go over what they actually do in the ovulatory and menstrual cycles. Both hormones bind to their receptors in the ovarian cells. LH on theca cells, FSH on granulosa cells. This binding will jointly cause the granulosa cells to make estrogen. I'll share with you how I remember this. First, remember that layered concentric circles imagery from earlier? Going from the ovum outward, we have the ovum, surrounded by the granulosa cells, surrounded by the follicular capsule, and then again by the theca cells. Just like in the adrenal cortex, hormones are funneled outward to inward. The two players here are androgen and estrogen. Estrogen has to be my end product since these are the ovaries, right? So that means that theca cells are the ones to make the androgens, which are funneled down to the granulosa cells, which will in turn convert it to estrogen under the influence of FSH. Make sense so far? And then the last trick I have is that, remember, theca cells are sort of outside the follicle. So in my head, it makes sense that FSH acts on the cells within the follicle, the granulosa cells, while LH acts on theca cells. Also, you'll remember that we said LH is what turns the follicular remnant into the corpus luteum. So it makes sense that LH acts on the outer layer of the follicle, since that's what's left behind after ovulation. It's definitely time to stop here for a question break. Let's start with this one. Which cells in the ovary do FSH and LH act on, respectively? FSH acts on the granulosa cells, while LH acts on the theca cells. Let's try another one. What hormone do theca cells produce in response to LH stimulation? Theca cells, in response to LH stimulation, make androstenedione. If you said androgen, you get your points, which is funneled down to the granulosa cell to be converted to estrogen. And I'll repeat this one more time. LH causes the theca cell to make the androgen androstenedione, which crosses to the granulosa cell. There, FSH stimulation of the enzyme aromatase causes conversion of androstenedione to estrogen. Additionally, FSH stimulates follicle maturation in preparation for ovulation. A surge in LH on day 14 is the inciting event of ovulation. More on this later. Okay, so we're back at after ovulation. The follicular theca and granulosa cells transform into luteal cells and make both estrogen and progesterone, which is now supported mostly by LH. Now, remember how I told you earlier that estrogen having that positive feedback was the only exception to our traditional endocrine feedback loops? Well then, what happens towards the end of the cycle for the cycle to begin again? Well, if there's no fertilization, the corpus luteum makes progesterone and estrogen, but those feedback negatively on the hypothalamus and pituitary, which means that as the corpus luteum grows and produces hormones under the influence of LH, it inhibits LH. If LH is inhibited, it can't support the corpus luteum anymore, which means it starts disintegrating. Of course, we don't want that to happen if there's going to be implantation, otherwise the endometrium will shed, as it does near the end of the menstrual cycle. How does the body know to remedy that? Well, if fertilization and uterine implantation occur, human chorionic gonadotropin, HCG, produced by the developing embryo prevents the degradation, involution, of the corpus luteum, continuing progesterone production to maintain the uterine endometrium. Basically, HCG is super similar structurally to LH and acts as a new LH to maintain the corpus luteum. However, if fertilization and implantation do not occur, the corpus luteum gradually degenerates, progesterone levels drop, and the endometrial lining breaks down, allowing the menstrual cycle to begin again. Part 5. How is control of ovulation and menstruation integrated? Now that we know about the follicles, corpus luteum, endometrium, and the regulatory hormones, let's put it all together and go back over the phases again with hormonal control added in. This will act as a nice synthesis too before we close off. The ovulatory cycle's follicular and luteal phases are separated by ovulation on day 14. Let's consider what happens in each phase. The follicular phase covers days 1 to 14 of the ovulation cycle. It's the beginning of the cycle, so every hormone level is low. FSH rises, which in turn makes a few follicles initiate the maturation cycle. As the follicles mature under FSH control, a few of them start to express LH receptors and release estrogen, which builds up the endometrium, which means that on the menstrual cycle side of things, we're now in the proliferative phase. The endometrium is rebuilding following menses, endometrial glands are developing, and endometrial cells are starting to express progesterone receptors. Let's look back at the follicle. It's making estrogen, so we see a dip in FSH around days 3-4, and as expected because of negative feedback. But now some of the follicles have built up LH receptors, so they can keep growing because of the circulating LH. Eventually, the cycle continues, and we're left with a single tertiary follicle that finished the first meiotic division. We're right before ovulation now. At this point, and I'm talking day 12 to 13, we have a huge follicle, so it's making a lot of estrogen. And like I said earlier, for some magical reason, there's an estrogen concentration threshold in the brain that makes estrogen have a positive instead of negative feedback. Again, this is the only plot twist endocrine-wise in the menstrual cycle. So what happens next? There's an LH surge that basically causes the tertiary follicle to burst, releasing the ovum into the fallopian tube. Quick break here. In the ovulatory cycle, when does estrogen act as part of a positive hypothalamic feedback system? During the late follicular phase, estrogen acts in a positive feedback system to cause a surge of GnRH and LH, inducing ovulation. Ovulation occurs at the end of the follicular phase, and once completed, it marks the transition from the follicular phase to the luteal phase. During this process, the tertiary follicle ruptures and releases the oocyte, which migrates to the uterine tube as the ovum. Ovulation occurs because the surge of LH binds to the tertiary follicle and initiates a signal transduction cascade that causes the follicle to secrete proteolytic enzymes. These enzymes degrade the follicular tissue, eroding the follicle wall to allow the egg to leave the follicle and the ovary. We're reaching the end, so please stick with me. What stage of the menstrual cycle is occurring while days 4 to 14 of the follicular phase is going on? The proliferative phase is happening at this time. I excluded days 1 to 4 or 5 because that is the menstrual stage. As far as the menstrual cycle is concerned, day 1 is defined by onset of menses, or bleeding, regardless of how long one cycle lasts. Alright, continuing now from where we left off. After the oocyte is released, the dominant tertiary follicle becomes the corpus luteum under the influence of LH. The corpus luteum is primarily dependent on LH for survival. It secretes progesterone and estrogen, increasing their levels. The high estrogen and progesterone levels suppress GnRH, FSH, and LH release. And remember our endometrium that built up all of the progesterone receptors during its proliferative phase? Well, now, progesterone from the corpus luteum gets to act on them, thereby transforming the endometrium so that the fertilized egg can implant within it. These changes include dramatically decreased mitotic activity, glandular secretion, increasing tortuosity of the glands, and changes within the endometrial stroma. This is referred to as the secretory phase of the menstrual cycle. Remember, depending on whether the egg is fertilized and implants in the uterus, two pathways are possible. The first pathway would be, in the absence of fertilization and implantation and without increasing levels of HCG, the corpus luteum atrophies on day 22, as progesterone levels peak and LH and FSH are minimal. If the corpus luteum atrophies, then there's no more progesterone to sustain the endometrium. Cue the menstrual phase. This phase includes fragmentation of endometrial glands, thrombosis or clotting, inflammatory cell infiltration, and degeneration of the endometrial stroma. And for the second pathway, if fertilization does occur, HCG, produced by the early implanted blastocyst and embryo, maintains the corpus luteum, which continues to produce the hormones needed for the early embryo to develop. This event is called the rescue of the corpus luteum. Let's stop here for a quick knowledge review. Which hormone most drives endometrial differentiation during the secretory phase? Progesterone is the hormone of pregnancy that drives endometrial differentiation assisted by estrogen. All right, we are finally done with ovulation and the menstrual cycle. I hope you were able to follow along with this hefty break. Ready for a review? Let's go! What are the three phases of the ovulatory cycle? The three phases of the ovulatory cycle are, in chronological order from day one, the follicular phase, ovulation, and the luteal phase. The menstrual cycle, which is a uterine event, is also divided into three phases, proliferative, secretory, and menstrual. Since the menstrual cycle is controlled by hormones released during the ovarian cycle, you can imagine that the stages of each cycle mostly overlap. For example, the secretory phase of the menstrual cycle mostly aligns with the luteal phase of the ovulatory cycle. What are the different stages of the follicles throughout folliculogenesis? Follicles begin as primordial follicles, nothing more than an ovum surrounded by a flat layer of granulosa cells. From there, these follicles progress to primary follicles, to secondary follicles, to tertiary follicles, all via stimulation by, you guessed it, follicle-stimulating hormone FSH. Folliculogenesis ends when the tertiary follicle either ruptures and releases its ovum, or, more commonly, when the follicle undergoes atresia. What structure does the follicle remnant become after ovulation? The remnant of the follicle, under the influence of the luteinizing hormone LH, becomes the corpus luteum, which produces progesterone and estradiol to sustain and feed the endometrium. Broadly, how does the endometrium change during the menstrual cycle? Remember, the endometrium thickens and shreds entirely based on when it expects to receive the fertilized ovum, which by that time would be the blastocyst. Implantation occurs 7 days after fertilization, which itself occurs 1 to 2 days after ovulation. Remember, that's day 14. So 14 plus 1 or 2 plus 7 lands us at days 22 or 23. This is when you'd expect your thickest, readiest endometrium. Which also then means after, say, day 23 or so, with no implantation in sight, the endometrium shrinks and shreds. Shredding marks onset of menses, and likewise, day 1 of the next cycle. And after menses ends, day 5, approximately, the endometrium rebuilds again. How do LH and FSH act on follicular cells to result in estrogen production? LH acts on the outer theca cells, stimulating them to make androgen. That androgen is funneled inward, where it is taken up by granulosa cells. FSH then acts on granulosa cells, stimulating them to convert that androgen into estrogen. In what context does estrogen exert a negative feedback on the hypothalamus and pituitary? Throughout most of the ovulatory cycle, estradiol inhibits release of GnRH from the hypothalamus and FSH-LH from the anterior pituitary. This negative feedback happens during most of the follicular phase. Remember that the only exception to this is right before ovulation, at which point the high concentration of estrogen tips the scale and causes a GnRH and LH surge. Ovulation occurs immediately after the pre-ovulatory LH surge. Can you describe what happens during the secretory phase of the menstrual cycle? During the secretory phase of the uterine cycle, progesterone acts on the estradiol-primed uterus to dramatically increase endometrial thickness. Loss of hormonal support causes sloughing of the endometrium, known as menses, and leads to monthly menstrual bleeding. And that's it! Great job hanging in there with me! Now, armed with your newfound knowledge on ovulation and the menstrual cycle, let's revisit our case from earlier. Thinking back to Sarah, how do you answer her question about how oral contraceptive pills work? You first briefly discussed the normal ovulatory cycle. You explained that ovulation occurs about 14 days before menses, right after a surge in a hormone called luteinizing hormone. Birth control pills act by blocking the surge of this hormone so that the egg is never released from the ovary. No LH surge, no released egg, no possible pregnancy. Sarah seems impressed and proceeds to ask you about the potential side effects, which you happily discuss. That's all for today. Make sure to like and subscribe to this podcast. Your feedback continuously helps us improve. You can also get the full RxBrix experience online at www.usmle-rx.com. I'll catch you on the next one.